This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Good evening and welcome. Tonight and for the coming three nights, we will be looking back over the life and times of one of our most distinguished living Irish writers, who has also made a significant contribution to the shaping of the cultural and artistic life of the state of modern Ireland. Anthony Cronin has been hailed in Ireland and abroad as a novelist, poet, biographer, critic, essayist and broadcaster. In a parallel career, his vision of the role and the status of the writer and artist in Irish society has led him, as cultural and artistic advisor to Taoiseach Charles J. Hockey, to play a major role in establishing such innovative institutions as Athlone and the Irish Museum of Modern Art. Anthony Cronin has received honorary degrees, served as a visiting poet and university lecturer in the United States, and in June 2003, President McAleese presented Anthony Cronin with his golden torque that symbolised his elevation to the status of C, the highest honour his peers in Athlone could confer on him. Anthony Cronin, born in Enniscorthy in County Wexford in 1928. Looking back now to 1928, all those years, what are the outstanding pictures you see of that time?
There was an atmosphere, I suppose you could say, of deep mistrust and lack of confidence in themselves, in people, in Ireland, in its future. And it wasn't at all, what I'm really trying to say is that when people look back now, they think of it as sort of pastoral, peaceful, deep-rooted, and all that. It wasn't like that. And there was also, there were lingering, I didn't encounter any myself, but there were lingering traces of violence, I suppose the violence of the preceding years in many departments of life. Later on, when I came to Dublin and was drinking at the pubs, looking back now, I can see that you were almost bound to witness or even encounter some form of violence or other before the night was over. That would be on a Thursday, Friday or Saturday.
It's interesting, your picture of the sort of psychological state, because we're, what, 4 or 5 years after independence, after the end of the Civil War. The state is now beginning. Presumably, there was immense poverty.
There was immense poverty. A lot of one's companions at the Christian Brothers School wore no footwear, winter or summer. And there was not only immense poverty, but there were evidences of poverty everywhere. You know, a lot of people were actually short of enough to eat, and many, many people had no futures in any real sense of the world, except the emigrant boat. But funnily enough, the emigrant boat probably didn't bulk as large in the Irish mind in the 1920s as it came to do later. I mean, the 1950s, it was the feature of Irish life, really.
And was there a sense then that the right decision in terms of the formation of the state had been made, or the wrong decision, or we could survive on our own, or we couldn't survive without Britain? Did those arguments linger?
Well, they arose again after de Valera's accession to office, Fianna Fáil's in 1932, and the economic war started. That brought relations with England to a new pitch of sharpness, and it also accentuated for many, many people the hardships and difficulties at the time. For others, of course, there was something of an improvement with the Fianna Fáil government that came in 1932, was bent on social reform and did carry out very large and very sweeping reforms. There was a huge housing drive. Much of Enniscorthy was rehoused. I mean, there were actually people living in mud walls, they would still have been, and thatched cottages in the outskirts streets of the town. I suppose where the Irish had clustered in the towns,
most of them refugees from the country, probably, originally.
Yes, yeah. And they were rehoused. You know, there was a serious housing drive, and there was a serious industrial employment drive, which was successful. Fianna Fáil was very successful in that. But it involved protectionism, of course, which was the beginning, perhaps, of their temptations.
You talk about your family because, obviously, almost all Irish families were crossed by history and politics. It absorbed almost everything in the period. What was yours like?
Well, they were apolitical, really. There was some talk on my mother's part. The great political division of a couple of decades before had been Parnellism or anti-Parnellism. And there was talk on my mother's part of what staunch Parnellites her people had been in County Kilkenny. I only remember one intervention in politics on my father's part. He wrote a letter to the local paper saying that the Labour Party had compromised itself by not exactly going into coalition with, it was a different arrangement. They undertook to support the Fianna Fáil government.
The minority
It was still a minority government in 1932. And he wrote saying this was a mistake.
So there's a Labour Party tradition in your...
No, I would think that he himself, individually, was mildly progressive in his views. He started life as a reporter on the Enniscorthy Echo. On the very week he took up his first duties, which would have been to report on the court cases and the funerals in Goree, which was 20 miles or so distant, all communication with Enniscorthy and everywhere else ceased. And when he got eventually, because he had there was no money coming through and he was worried about his digs, he got on his bicycle and started to cycle to Enniscorthy. The first news he got was from a detachment of British Lancers that he met, who asked him, seemed surprised that he hadn't heard about the Shinners.
In 1960s?
Yeah, and when he got to the Echo itself, the entire staff had been more or less arrested and sent off to Frangach. The Echo was a fairly nationalist paper, except one who turned out to be a very patriotic newspaper columnist later on, Ada Blochum. He was Roddy the Rover of the Irish press, and he told my father it was a mistake not to have been arrested, that they were both unlucky.
That they would be rewarded later on for being arrested.
Yes, if you had been arrested, you would have been rewarded later.
Now, you went to Blackrock College. You went all the way from Wexford up to Dublin to Blackrock College, very famous college, amongst others who attended that school, John Charles McQuaid and Eamon de Valera. Why did they send you to Blackrock?
I have no idea, really. Lots of people were sent away to school at the time by people who could afford it. That was my case, our case. My brother was there slightly before me. I was of tender years, and I feel now quite strongly that not that I was especially a mother's boy. My ambition probably would have been to escape from mothers and that sort of thing. But I think now it is too early to be separated. You know, when you're 12 or 13, it's too early to be separated from.
On that theme, you have selected one of your poems. It's For a Father.
For a father, with the exact length and pace of his father's stride, the son walks. Echoes and intonations of his father's speech are heard when he talks. Once, when the table was tall and the chair a wood, he absorbed his father's smile and carefully copied the way that he stood. He grew into exile slowly, with pride and remorse, in some ways better than his begetters, in others worse. And now, having chosen with strangers, half glad of his choice, he smiles with his father's hesitant smile and speaks with his voice.
Your father's ghost is still there, Tony.
Yes, I was. Oh, he's still there. He still pops up here.
In what ways?
There. In poems and that. I for a long time, I mean, he's in more than one poem, though not as usually as directly as that. But he symbolized a lot of things to me. The fact that virtue is not its own reward, particularly the lower middle class virtues. The lower middle class idea really was that you had to work for everything you got, and that nothing came easy. There wasn't much there anyway. But all that turned out to be untrue, didn't it?
And where did the bohemian in you come from?
Oh, there must have been streaks unacknowledged somewhere. These things are often lurking for generations.
Because you go to one of the finest schools in the country and you graduate and you're called to the bar, and then you set off on a very difficult career as a writer with the threat of starvation hanging over your head.
Well, it didn't quite happen like that, and I suppose I was raffish enough as a student, you could say, maybe. And it was more a decision not to engage in the ways of the world. When I was called to the bar, I had no real intention of practicing. I'd long lost any interest in the matter. But a lot of people took jobs immediately in those days. They had no great hopes of practicing or ambitions to practice. And there was a job going, and I took it, I got it, I should say, because there were a huge number of applicants. And I borrowed an overcoat from our former attorney general, turned up for interview and got the job. And it was an account of the job, basically. I mean, it's a comic account, and it has its exaggerations of one kind or another in a book called The Life of Riley. I saw enough of the ways of the world not to want to engage very much.
Really. That interests me. Why did you want to be different, and what did you mean by being different? Was that ego on your part or
no.
exploration on your part? Or
no,
what was it?
No. I always ascribe a lot to drift, Tom.
Drift?
Yes. I drift has played a large part in my life, and I'm quite sure that it plays a much larger part in most people's lives than it's given credit for. Drift, happenstance, circumstance, that sort of thing, you know. I had begun to publish.
Yeah.
That poem that we
For a Father,
read,
yes.
Yes. It was the first significant poem I published. And the amazing thing about those days was that you could acquire a reputation on a single poem.
Yes.
You wouldn't have any hope whatever of doing that nowadays. But there are hundreds of poets arriving.
Let me take you back to your notion of drift, which I find interesting. I mean, is there... Do you think it's preordained where you're going to be washed up, or is it still in the lap of the gods, or are you following some fantasy in your own head, or what? Or are you tempting fate?
Tempting fate is better.
Is it?
Yes, I think that's better. Tempting what it seemed to be. I was irked by the whole business from quite early childhood. And going away to school and all that kind of thing, that others made all the decisions for you and you had to knuckle down and get in there and obey. And I was impatient of bonds, and you could say obligations too, I think.
You weren't frightened?
No,
of where your drifting might end up.
Well, there were a large number of people dropping out of one thing or another. Again, there's a description in Dead as Doornails, more or less, and in The Life of Riley, of the concourse of people in those days that there was to join in idleness and squalor.
My agonies at an end for a few brief hours, I would make straight for a pub called O'Turk's, an establishment which, whatever its merits or demerits, had a mental atmosphere in stern and refreshing contrast to that prevailing in the grocer's headquarters, or indeed in that other establishment where the secretary discoursed in the tongue with his fellow secretaries, permanent, under, departmental, and simple, like himself. For the key and cardinal principle of O'Turk's was gurrierdom. Here, not success, but unsuccess was looked upon with favour. Here, the man who made a hames of it and continued, whatever the obstacles, to make a hames of it, was the man of fashion. Hence, O'Turk's had a high proportion of beggars, and of successful and well-to-do beggars at that, not ordinary, commoner garden, public-house touchers. Of course, not everybody could set up as a beggar. There had to be a history of sacrifice or misfortune or oddity to enable one to qualify. And here there were distinctions not readily apparent to the outsider. Plain congenital idiocy would not do, for a beggar was expected to be a sharp fellow and, if possible, a wit. But a maladroitness in affairs amounting to an inability to hold any ordinary employment, and preferably having resulted in the loss of a sum of inherited money, or the destruction of an inherited business at some time in the past, or, what was equally good, the repute of it, would. Patriotic service in one of the extremist organisations which had flourished in the 30s and in the war years was a splendid qualification for the role. But this was tricky ground, for not only was it difficult to distinguish between extremist patriotic activities and several other offences known to the law, but it was not difficult for the unqualified to invent an extremist present about which they were naturally sworn to secrecy. And there were, in fact, a number of outrageously ignorant but quite voluble Marxists who belonged to a neo-communist organisation, in fact seemed largely to control its destinies. Though why this should have debarred them from other employment than that of a beggar in the pub was not made clear. This overcrowding and this confusion rendered the extremist role a tricky one to adopt, though it was admitted on all sides, of course, to be a proper qualification. Literary and artistic occupations were also, in a way, accounted sufficient, though here again there were snags. It was better for the true beggar not to have published or painted anything at all, for to do so smacked almost of having a job, and one was more likely to be begged from than permitted by the necessary common consent to beg. Conversely, of course, a degree of literacy was required, or an ability to pretend to it. I mean common literacy. It was difficult to pretend that one could write if it was known that one could not read.
Now, Life of Riley, published in 1964, and the extract, I mean, it's an extraordinary description of the institution of the Irish pub in the 1940s and 50s. And it was more than just a pub. It was a gathering, it was a parliament, it was a marketplace, it was a refuge. It was a celebration of failure.
Yes, that's quite true. That's a good, accurate description. I think, actually, you know, I mean, I don't want to make anything too high-sounding, but I was in love with failure, and I was in love with it as virtually a principle. You know, let success be for those that wanted it, but let me be among the honourable those who fail.
Well, what do you mean by failure? How would you define failure?
Failure to, I suppose, it's a failure of the ambition instinct or even the self-preservation instinct, you know. Not trying to be among the masters, to join the dispossessed. And the,
you wanted to be in the chorus line?
Well, I wanted to be other things. The two states weren't, you know, that and a kind of success were not mutually exclusive.
Now you're,
and I was tasting one anyway.
You're opting out. you're stepping away.
Yes, that's right. Later on, it would have been known as dropping out.
Yeah.
But such a phrase didn't exist then. So.
Now, let me talk about your beginning to write on the creative processes. Presumably, the engine in all of this was the creative process, wasn't it? In your attitudes.
Yes, yes.
And when did you discover there was an engine there?
Well, I think my doom was sealed quite early. At Black Rock, we had a compulsory 4 hour study every day. And a cleric would pace up and down between the desks to make sure that you weren't reading, you know, Buffalo Bill or something, that you were reading only literature that was there for scholarly purposes. And if you were reading history or poetry, he couldn't conceive of you doing it for fun.
Yes.
Or doing it for pleasure. So I actually imported books and kept them in my desk along with all the school books and took them out in the evening and happily read for those 4 hours Carlyle's French Revolution, for example. Seems an unlikely book, but and also poems. And he would look down and he'd see these irregular lines on the page. It was poetry. And you must be studying it. You must be learning it by heart or something. So I read a lot of poetry. And in particular, Robert Browning. I was deeply, deeply taken with Browning. I still am. I think he's a very great poet indeed.
You were actually conducting an alternative education.
I was, yes.
Within the wider nucleus.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And that was my education.
And that set something off all of 60, 70 years ago. A flame was lit, which has never gone out.
Well, that's true, yeah. But I don't want to make it sound heroic or anything, Tom. Apart from drift, there is compulsion. There is the unease, now the word angst I think was just coming in, that is set up in anybody who really wants to do it by not doing it.
Well, of course, and if you go back to Life of Riley, you create an impression of a city, Dublin, of a capital of a country where everybody was doing it. Seemingly everybody had a manuscript in their pocket.
Well, it's a world that I'm describing. It's not
the
real world in the sense.
What was it, do you think, that drove so many people at that particular moment in Irish life? And I suspect nothing quite like it exists now. And I remember it many years ago. I got the end of it in McDade's. There were so many writers, so many people obsessed with writing and literature. What was it fulfilling in society that wasn't happening elsewhere?
That's a good question.
There was great intensity, yeah. Wasn't there?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It was like maybe an alternative education in a sense.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that I can answer it. The rewards of other kind of activity were not so spectacular or sought after or to be sought after as they are nowadays.
Is it the crisis of the post-colonial society when they're still trying to sort out who they are and where they are?
It's to make an abstraction of things.
Is it really?
At least for me, Tom, that would be thinking of it in very abstract or over-analytic or social terms, you know.
But you had that huge schism in the 1920s when you had 300-400 years of an established order disappear, and then Irish society, in your generation, you're the first generation of independence, are trying to resolve and set about so many of the questions left unanswered.
Well, I think that's too historical. You see, I think that the Ireland of the Free State and after was much more of a seamless continuum with what had gone before.
Really?
Oh, yes, than people imagined. I mean, it wasn't like the Russian Revolution of 1917, a great transmogrification of society. It wasn't even sort of as deep or as far-reaching as the changes the Nazi thugs made in German society. No, it was much more a seamless continuum, so that people didn't notice the transition very much. Yeah, you can see that even in official life and official photographs, when they all put on their morning coats or their frock coats and their top hats, and they went to the Viceregal Lodge and to the Vice Governor General's box at the horse show. You know, it was a very British Ireland, very British Ireland indeed. And protest against the Britishness of Ireland was regarded by the vast majority of the population as extremist troublemakers. You know, they were quite happy with this smooth transition.
So where was the revolution? Or was there one?
Well, you might well ask. I think myself that the revolution probably died in 1916. It died before the firing squads of 1916. There wasn't one. There was a rebellion, a successful rebellion. But that's a very, very different matter from a revolution.
So you got a neo-colonial society, in many ways.
Well, I don't think anybody thought of Ireland as having been a colony.
Yeah.
I think that came much, much later. I think that was invented in the 1970s. I may be very wrong in attributing the invention to Garrett Fitzgerald, but that's the sort of memory I have. But it certainly wasn't an invention of much later on. People did not think of the Ireland that had gone before as a colony of anywhere. And even though they kept quiet about it and that, vast numbers had, you know, joined the British Army as a regular course, not just to supposedly fight for a world fit for heroes to live in. And Ireland had been nationalist in temper, constitutional nationalist in temper for quite a long time, and had been self-governing in various, all sorts of ways. But certainly most people would have regarded it as an insult if you had told them they had been living in a colony and that they were colonials, or they were whatever, natives looking up to their colonial masters.
Let me bring you on to one of the most fascinating Irish historical figures who's through all of this, Padraig O'Donnell. And you worked on the Bell with Padraig O'Donnell.
I did.
Remarkable man in many ways.
Yes, there was an extended portrait of him, I mean comic portrait, fictional portrait, in that book you've adverted to, The Life of Riley. There was a fraudulent side to Pather, you know, quite a strong fraudulent
really?
Side. Oh, yes, yes. As I think other people recognise, not just me. He was a hero of sorts as well, though never very deeply so to me. He was quite willing that I should do all the work on the Bell and take the brunt of things, while he sort of luxuriated in the idea that he was still editor of.
But the Bell, apart from that, also associated with Seán Ó Fhuaileáin. How important was the Bell?
Oh, it was immensely important. I suppose it was an important as a place where of social commentary, where Irish life was described in sociological terms, in documentary terms, in ways that it had never been before. But it was also important as a literary thing. I said earlier that you could establish a reputation on one poem. In those days, to have a poem in the Bell, or as I had, a poem in Envoy, which was a much more avant-garde thing, would bring you to people's attention overnight, which wouldn't be the case now, not by any means. I mean, the places where people have to publish their poems are teeming with other poets. They were the only places there was for certain kinds of publication, and that made them important. It was a very, very narrow place, Ireland, with very, very few distractions even. The only distraction the people of Dublin had, apart from the pub, was the cinema, which huge queues used to form every Friday and Saturday night, stretching round the block to go to the Savoy or the Metropole or the Capitol. And then there were the dance halls. But as a place with distractions, there weren't any. Anything there was important. Do you understand me? Anything there was significant, because there was so little of anything.
It is the contemporary claim that we were brought up in a very oppressive society, dominated by the church, dominated by guilt, and dominated by a particular form of education. A lot of contemporary Irish writers are deeply angry about that. Would you accept that?
No.
Vision?
No, I wouldn't accept that. I wrote a piece, John Banville edited a book of pieces about the decades recently, and I contributed a piece about the 1950s.
Why would you reject that?
Well, certainly we, when I say we, I mean me and a small number of other people, including Kavanagh, looked on the enemy as the people themselves, the Irish people themselves. These were not tyrannies imposed on them from outside. These were the products of their own choosing, and in many ways were a reflection of themselves. The kind of politics we had was a reflection of the Irish people, and a very faithful reflection of the Irish people. The church we had was largely staffed and composed by the people. You know, every third or fourth farmer of a certain social standing had a priest in the family. And these were the people that made up not only the ordinary priesthood, but the bishoprics and everything else. And it wasn't as if some malign or malevolent force had wished any sort of tyrannies on people. They choose them themselves.
You see, it's the modern theory of the victim.
It is, of course, yeah. And people love the idea because it brings us in line with other European countries, you know, Franco's Spain, even Hitler's Germany, Stalin's Russia.
So McQuaid's
Ireland.
McQuaid's Ireland is a myth of the modern Irish leadership.
Yes, it's a myth in the sense that it's constantly suggested that it was imposed on people. It wasn't imposed on people. What they were doing was they were choosing things which were very near to themselves, and in an imperfect world where the processes were not perhaps perfect enough for some wishes to be acceded to, these places were near enough what they wanted.
I mean, we have many people nowadays congratulating themselves that they finally reached a place called Modern Ireland.
Yes.
I'm sure you have interesting thoughts on what you would contrast with the modern as a... What was it, the pre-modern Ireland or the old Ireland?
Well,
let
me say first of all, Tom, that one is constantly up against the problem of people who nowadays, from their safe vantage point, strike liberal attitudes about this, that and the other, or progressive attitudes about this, that and the other. And by some mental shift, they were there and choosing these attitudes in spite of all terrors and temptations at the time. They weren't the exact same people, the same kind of people, were pillars of church and state and were writing the newspapers, for example. You know, in what way do they differ? They're exact counterparts. In other words, I'm convinced that it's only just following a fashion,
well,
really. A lot of it is following a fashion.
Well, you've seen how contemporary society depicts the island of the past. Is that a place you recognise or you'd accept?
I don't recognise it in its simplifications and its self-pity. You know, the self-pity from now is sort of given to it. You would think it was like living under the Taliban, but it wasn't like living under the Taliban. It was a Taliban with many chinks in its armour, including places like MacDade's. And there was a lively underground, or various lively undergrounds, overlapping sometimes. And there was a good deal of Samizdat activity of one kind or another. You know, the editors of Envoy looked upon it as a sort of Samizdat thing.
Let me come back to the poems, because we're going to look at the end of the modern world. You have 10 collections of poetry, of course, but the end of the modern world, you're most ambitious.
It's a long sequence of poems which are concerned with history and our situation now as history led up to it. There are many historical characters and situations. This is about the outbreak of the First World War. The first one echoes a German eyewitness who was present in Berlin that night, and the second, it's supposed to be him speaking, and the second is simply a picture we all have in a way based on British-Irish experience. In the summer twilight, thousands fill the streets, embracing, weeping, eyes and faces shining. And then as darkness fell, there came the singing, the old heartbreaking songs, the mighty soaring, Es braust ein Ruf wie Donnerhall, and after, the stern, strong hymn of German Protestants, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott. I moved slowly along the Wilhelmstrasse with them. It was as if I floated with the crowds, forgetful now of self, immersed like them in a great tide of Germanness, of oneness. Although what was to come was terrible, that night seemed still august, magnificent. I shiver when I think of it today. How sad the bugle in the wood's green depths, aching for what is lost now to the world, least told of all tales now, least sung of songs, since on those summer roads the marching boys sang out between the poplars in their dream of death in some great circumstance of friends. Some proof of love beyond the dull demands they never had expected made each dawning among the little houses, little streets, between the window and the door of bedrooms, in offices where courage was submission, where duty was a dragging chain, and sacrifice a grim, sad burden carried to the end. No bugle sounding, even for the brave.
Your work was described as having an innate lyrical gift, honesty to human experience, imminent humour, and sheer poetic intelligence. Can we talk about poetry?
Yes.
I suppose the best moments for you as a writer have been when you've been writing and been able to write poetry.
Not entirely. Not entirely. I've always enjoyed writing prose. I don't just mean writing non-poetry. I like to write prose, which is a dying art. I would say that the number of people who appreciate good prose in proportion to the number of people who read books is much smaller than the number who perhaps appreciate poetry. Prose as a connoisseur's thing has gone. And you'll even see that reflected in reviewing, you know, where aspects of the writing are seldom mentioned. There are great satisfactions to be got from writing prose. But that said, I've always tried to keep the two as close together as possible. I think poetry should be much more part of the world than people will allow it or encourage it to be. When poetry is strong and flexing its muscles and prepared to take on all comers, it takes on lots of things, history, philosophy, politics, and it takes on the whole business of creating other people, of peopling a world, as Shakespeare did. When poetry is weak, on the other hand, everybody writes personal lyrics about their own personal emotions, something that's quite alien to a poet like Browning, who did write personal lyrics about his own personal emotions, but who created whole worlds, you know, and wrote history in poetry, philosophy in poetry, politics in poetry. And that's what one of the things I was trying to do at the end of the modern world, to bring the world within the scope of poetry, instead of sort of saying it's outside poetry's scope.
In 1979, your novel Identity Papers was published, and it's set in the summer of 1966, and that's an important date for you. The psychosexual preoccupations and the attitudes of the characters is concerned.
Yeah, well, the 60s, you know, was a significant enough time in its way, and I had been in the United States for most of the decade. And so when he came back, the surprising thing was how long it had taken the 60s to dawn in Ireland. But it had dawned, and it was the end of the old Ireland, really, wasn't it?
Nothing was ever the same since, was it?
Nothing was ever the same since. I think the change began in the 1950s, which the 1950s were a strange decade. The art of the post-war, of the decades after the war, the 40s and 50s, is very great, but very peculiar, very strange. For the first time, the soul of man seemed to have been laid bare in certain fundamental ways. I'm thinking of Beckett now. I'm thinking of Francis Bacon. I'm thinking of a number of people of whom they would be perhaps the best known. But the human condition was exposed in a way that has never been exposed. It had never been exposed before, but even more strange, never has been since. I mean, what happened was that capitalism recovered and recovered its nerve, and it began to feed people all sorts of things to keep them, in a way. I mean, I don't say this, people sat in conflict and made a conscious decision to keep them from thinking about the human condition.
Yes.
In the way that Beckett thought about it and wrote about it, or Francis Bacon portrayed it. And that's how we've been ever since, but only increasingly so.
To many of our listeners, finally, Tony Cronin, you'll be known for Sunday Miscellany, which in its own way and at its height of its powers in the 70s and 80s was an extraordinary radio programme. There was yourself, Ben Kiley, John Jordan, writing every week these essays. You talked about the importance of prose and the elegance of the writing. It really was a golden generation, and in many ways that programme was your great shop window, wasn't it, of that generation?
It was, yes. It was a rather wonderful thing. This was entirely inspired by Ronnie Walsh, I would have to say, an actor, Ronnie Walsh. And he assembled those contributors, and he cajoled them successfully, got them in front of the microphone every week and sober enough to do themselves justice. And it really was remarkable, yes.
I remember you all coming in to Henry Street, even. It was like the senators in ancient Rome assembling once a week to read your missives and to exchange and talk to each other.
Mm.
So it had society and gathering and writing. And it was also, in a curious way, the triumph of radio, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Radio has these repeated triumphs, you know. People are always writing it off, and then it comes back in one way or another. But it was the acme of radio in a way. It was what radio could do as a way of conveying thoughts to people, or attitudes, or feelings to people. And the one of the things that I think was most successful about it was that although most of those contributions were certainly very well written, sometimes beautifully written, they weren't delivered like essays or like prose. They were delivered in a very radio-ish way.
And the whole generation triumphed. It really was the triumph of your generation. You could almost be called, dare I say it, the Sunday Miscellany generation. Would that be fair?
Well, it wouldn't be. It wouldn't offend, because I have quite happy memories of the programme.
Has radio anything like that now?
Not that I know of, Tom, though there is quite a lot of good stuff on the radio. But then radio, it doesn't have what it had before. It always has something else, it seems to me. For instance, the verse plays, yes, that were encouraged, yes, by the BBC Third Programme and then by RTE, and radio drama of a kind that there has never been since.
It was fascinating how, with people like Louis McNeice and so on, and Bertie Rogers, that radio became the writer's medium very easily,
yes,
very happily.
Well, the Third Programme was very brave, because it was specifically a minority programme. I mean, people were told that's what we're doing here. We're not looking for vast listenerships, and we're not competing in the figures with anybody. We're doing our thing here. Now, that's one of the bad things that has happened to the world. Everybody has been forced to compete for the figures, for the...
We're a world run by accountants?
Yes. I mean, the novelists of my youth, for example, a lot of them never expected to make any money. They never expected to have certain kinds of fame. But nearly everybody is forced in subtle ways into the competition now for the big readership, the big money, the big prizes, which I think have had a very deleterious effect.
Anthony Cronin, thank you very much. Join us tomorrow night for the next part in this series.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/Radio 1.